Expanding Mind with Eric Davis, Thursdays at 2 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis. Today's show, we'll be exploring media ecology and other related phantasms of the mind and the scene. You know, it's always tough when I think about this show as how I describe it, because it's really a podcast, and I hate the word podcast. And it's partly because the word podcast is so demeaning and kind of materialistic, like a little dictative. It's such a individual, and, you know, it's got that pod, like that Apple brand thing, which, you know, nobody really wants to hear about. And it's sort of a frustrating kind of word. And radio, on the other hand, is such a marvelous term. You know, the radio, it's just there. It's part of reality. It's part of physical reality. And one of the things I like about the Progressive Radio Network is, well, it's called Radio Network, even though it's not really radio. But it has aspirations to be radio and to be radio-like. And radio-like not just because hopefully it will one day be on the radio as well, and maybe some shows already are, but that it's a stream. It's a continuous stream of different people carrying the load, passing the baton from – one person to the next. So even though this is a podcast, I still like to think of it as internet radio, and such reflections on media arcology and the nature of this space that we're sharing. I guess I had some noise on the line earlier, but hopefully it will all be solved. Maybe that's even part of the mystery as well. We'll be able to explore a little more fully with our guest today, Jerry Fialka, who's an excellent person to talk to media about. Really a fascinating character, experimental filmmaker, curator, paramedia ecologist, and a great conversationalist, somebody who really takes the interview and the conversation seriously in many different media zones. But we love conversation here on Expanding Mind. And our other conversant for the day is, of course, our co-host, Maja Daou. Maja, how you doing?
Doing good, Eric. How are you?
Pretty good. I sound okay now. I guess I was sort of cutting out there for a little while.
I know. It was the radio gods infusing irony into what you were saying.
Absolutely. Just as I was being too meta.
Exactly. They're like, oh, yeah? Check this out.
Oh, yeah? You think it's all like, oh, you're going to say it's radio. Well, it's not radio because it's some digital signal that's getting screwed up.
It's the ghost in the machine.
Yeah, it is such a different thing. I mean, like radio, just we take it for granted, but it's remarkable that you know we're bathing in it all the time.
I know,
and
that's
all
the
you
thing.
Need
is
to do
is
you need to have this tiny little device, and they can be very simple,
yeah.
And you can pick up these extraordinary waves.
You know what? I love that you can make a radio out of a crystal, like quartz crystals. I know everyone gets down on crystals because they're all new agey, but dude, you can make radios and computers out of them and just send out waves and transmissions from them with an amplifier. It's kind of amazing.
Yeah, that's it's something to meditate upon.
Indeed.
So with that, let's bring on Jerry Fialka. Jerry, you're calling. Are you you're in Venice right now?
I'm in Venice, California, Eric, and it's great to hear both of your voices in the discarnate state. And, yeah, let's continue on this genuine fake radio conversation. So, yeah, we're exploring the dualities, you know, of internet and radio and conversation and the discarnate that we're both, all three of us are in. We're without bodies right now. And we learned this from Mad Magazine, this duality. Many of us grew up learning this. What they employed, what John Cage did, is when you satirize something and condense it, then you can get it. And Alfred E. Newman said that The English language is the only language where a double negative is a no-no. And indeed, another duality or doubleness is the word laugh tears, which is James Joyce inventing a word or culture jamming or mashing up two words to come up with a new word, laugh tears. And he sat in Paris in the 20s and listened to shortwave radio and wrote it all down and created the Internet, or actually created what's going to be after the Internet, and disguised it as a book. So just take this word laugh tears, and, you know, Gurdjieff said that laughing is the reconciliation of yes and no. So there's our duality doubleness again. And then tears, well, my mother taught me, and thank God we have a woman on the line, because this hate these things to become boys' clubs. And my mother taught me that when you cry, you get all that bad stuff out of your body. Those tears contain all this stuff that needs to get out. It's almost like peeing.
Well, I always like how tear and tear are etymologically related. And tear, of course, is to rend open or rip apart. And, of course, when you have a tear, that's pretty much opening the orifice and getting out what's in there. So it's exactly as you said.
And that's
well,
how we
begin. They're both ecstasies, too. You know, I was reading, you know, good old George Bataille, and he was talking about ecstasy in a kind of mystical sense of really losing yourself, of like being able to finally, you know, slip out of that calculating ego meat machine that's constantly having these projects that it's doing in relationship to some future that it never really lets arrive because it's always creating a new project. And yet there are these sort of moments of ecstasy, and he was talking about it in the kind of big deal mystical sense, but then he just shifted right over and just talked about the way that laughter can like break down all of these separate beings that we feel like we are and create this moment of what he called communication, which is kind of interesting, talking about McLuhan and talking about which we will, and talking about Joyce and this sort of idea of communication, not as me sitting over here saying some thing that I put in a package and then give to you and you unpack it and swallow it, but communication as an ambient network, like a radio, like a broadcast situation where there are these radiating waves that are shivering and shimmering between us and within us simultaneously. So it's a laughter and a tear and a tear.
Well put, Eric, and both of you. And my mother, on a tribute to my mother, she named me after the patron saint of mothers, Saint Gerard. My name is actually Gerald, and I was then destined to work for Frank Zappa because he had a group called the Mothers of Invention. And indeed, he knew by saying in one of his albums, Roxy and Elsewhere, nothing is what I want. So in this doubleness, and he's evoking Alan Watts there, that we have to embrace contradiction and not demonize it. That is what the yin and the yang is. That is what Finnegan's Wake is by James Joyce, and that's why McLuhan called Joyce, he called all his work Applied Joyce. The Wake is basically about rise and fall. So we rise and we fall. And we have language on language. He has a great word in the middle of the book called Winnegan's Fake. So again, that's what we're exploring, radio on radio. We're exploring conversation on conversation. And Fireside Theater said it well, everything you know is wrong. So how do we embrace these contradictions? Marshall said it well, you mean my whole fallacy is wrong? Now, many people don't know, Marshall got popular from being in Annie Hall by Woody Allen, and Woody Allen, and, you know, all the power to Woody for bringing Marshall to many people in the middle of his film, but he had Marshall say that statement in his film as a statement, and Marshall was really about questions and inventing new metaphors and new questions, or as the song we heard just before we came on, Brother, Can You Paradigm, and inventing new paradigms. And so Marshall would normally say, you mean my whole fallacy is wrong, as a question. And Woody flipped it and made him say it as a statement. That's all right, because Marshall's other great embrace contradiction line is, carefully make plans, then do the opposite.
That's great. I want to take a step back and let you frame a little bit about Marshall McLuhan, because this year there was a kind of, you know, little brouhaha about him again because of the centennial. And
right.
So there was a sense of return. You know, I've always been a fan, but there were, you know, times, especially right. on the edges of academia, where it's very no-no to say that you like Marshall McLuhan. But for people who don't necessarily, you know, or just they just heard his name or think about, like, oh, the medium is the message, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
Give us a little sense about him.
Yeah, that's a really good way to start. My friend was at a cocktail party with Richard Schinkel of Time Magazine's great film critic and scholar, and he says, so what do you think of McLuhan? And Richard goes, fraud. And then he turns to him, he goes, well, three-quarters fraud. And it was like, well, that's the counterculturally correct answer, Mr. Schinkel. But did you know that he was a Menippean satirist? And do you even know what that means? Because Menippean satire is really what Marshall is about, and being what he called applied Joyce. So you go to Wikipedia and you learn that Marshall's a technological determinist, which means the Civil War was caused by the telegraph and the radio caused World War II. And as Robert Dobbs can so astutely tell you, that the 9/11 was caused by the cell phone. But that's called technological determinism, and that's not what Marshall was exclusively. He was both, again, embracing contradiction. He was a Menippean satirist. So if you study Donald Thiel, one of the guys who really got Marshall, very few people really got Marshall, and the people who didn't is because they don't study Finnegan's Wake. They're non-Finneganese, and not to be elitist, we don't like to call them failed McLuhanites. We like to call them non-Finneganese McLuhanites. And so it is simply that Marshall, and Menippean satire, really quick, is like when you're a Zappa fan and you're tapping your foot to a Frank Zappa song at a concert, and all of a sudden at the end of the song he sings a Boy George song. Do you really want to hurt me? And they're like snooty, and they're like, I hate pop music and I hate Boy George. How did you get me to sing his song in the middle of your song? So you use the medium itself as part of the satire. Woody turns to the audience in the middle, Woody, of Annie Hall, and he talks to the film viewer. He breaks that wall. So that's Menippean satire. Rabelais, Lewis Carroll, and Joyce were all Menippean satirists. So just to give you that little background on that, now Marshall, being a Menippean satirist, he was in the world of academics. He was in the academic world. And he was teasing, as Donald Thiel says, teasing people to believe his percepts were theories. So you will get Marshall's new book, just hit the bookstores. Go out and buy it. It's great, called Theories of Communication. And it's co-written by his son, Eric McLuhan. And indeed, what he's doing, Ian Eric spells it out right away. My dad wasn't a theorist, but he had to play the game. Just like you guys are like Charlie Parker, you're electricians and you're wiring us right now. You don't say that. You say, I'm a podcaster. I'm a genuine fake radio DJ conversationalist. But in the midst of this, you're allowing us to reinvent what radio and conversation is. So
that's really where, like, the trickster steps onto the scene, right? I mean, I think with Marshall, he was really into that kind of trickster mentality where you establish some kind of, like, ground rules, right? You kind of sneak into the established structure, and then you just throw it for a loop, right? Like with what you were saying with Frank Zappa, he sneaks in by establishing this kind of thing where people are like, okay, this is cool because I can fit it into this echelon, and Frank Zappa is acceptable. And then he uses that to then sneak in to break open people's head in this other
Beautiful.
Way by kind of planting these little seeds of coyote-ish tricksterism that
right.
ends up just popping open that little compartment that you thought it was stuck into.
Well put. And indeed, Marshall wouldn't really admit he was a tricksterist. You know, and he's like, I'm an academic. you know, and he would be, it's almost like you don't want to even set up. I guess Wyndham Lewis nailed it about sort of like the LaRouche of his time. He invented prank phone calls. Big influence on Marshall. He says, I am part communist and part fascist, with a healthy dose of monarchism in my Marxism, but at bottom, an anarchist with a passion for order. So this is, again, embracing contradiction, but this is where these people, we stand on the shoulders of these giants, they take it one step further. It's not like anybody can make a fake documentary. So what? But Craig Baldwin, our dear comrade, can make a fake documentary. And that's the third step. The new thing you have not thought of, and it's out of Greek philosophy, and it's called tertium quid, T-E-R-T-I-U-M. It's an undiscovered resolution, or it's in that alchemy world. You know, this third thing. So we can blend matching and making. We can blend light on and light through. We can blend, merge, marry, or since we're in California, it's like a combo burrito. The right brain and the left brain. It's like hybridizing. How do we take two things, internet radio and conversation, and turn it into a third thing?
It's the Mysterium Conjunctio.
Whoa, where'd you get that word?
That's alchemy, right? Unification of the opposites.
I like that. You're
yeah.
teaching me something. I love that. And see, Marshall's main thing was that don't have a point of view. He said an important thing. Understanding is having no point of view. I often question people about this. Are we hardwired to have point of view? Well, Marshall said as soon as they invented perspective in art, then the vanishing point, then all of a sudden we had point of view. Before we had spoken word, people just walked around and their inner and their outer weren't separate. T.S. Eliot said that poetry is outing your inner dialogue. So why do we even have to out our inner dialogue? Why isn't our outer dialogue and our inner dialogue one thing? Well, Eric, you're sort of the godhead of that whole culture. Hey, we can blend the two. We can return back to blending the inner and the outer. That's the cosmos. We want to roam free in the cosmos. And so, you know, that's Marshall was saying, let's uncover the hidden effects of the things we invent, these hidden environments. We're not aware that the car enhances and intensifies private mobility. We think, oh, the car just gets me from this point to that point faster, and it's efficient, and I can listen to the radio on it, too. But we're all in these private little mobile units, and we're not like a pack of wolves moving in, like, you know, public transportation isn't, you know.
Well, the car's a great example of one of those, like you say. I mean, you know, from the utilitarian, you know, individual point of view, it's like, oh, it's a great device. It gets me from here to there. But the entire city of Los Angeles is the way it is as a weird, you know, world capital of you know, oddities and a strange sense of desolation connected with this exuberant visuality, this sort of sense of moving through space. It's very peculiar to the city that everybody notes who goes there, who lives there, spends any time there. It's all about the car. So the car creates an entire way of moving through space. And like the classic example in like Los Angeles history is the rise of all the sort of crazy vernacular architecture in the 20s and 30s, you know, famous stuff like, you know, where this gets back to your Manipium satires, like the orange stand that looks like an orange. You know,
right.
This huge orange, or the hot dog stand that's built like a huge hot dog.
Oh,
or
your
or Derby or whatever. Yeah. And all these crazy architectural expressions emerge because people are in cars and they're driving faster and they have to look at the landscape in a different way.
Your books, you know, bring this out, Eric, so well. And I'm glad you brought up the word city because I'm about to be published on Craig Baldwin's other zine online magazine, so we don't need no stinking paper, and you know, we got it online now. And the name of the article is McLuhan's City as Classroom Flips into All-at-Onceness as Classroom. So Marshall said, hey, the city is a classroom. We know that. The real learning's outside the classroom. And that, you know, bringing up the word city remind me of that. And then how can it flip into all-at-onceness as classroom? Again, we go back to Wyndham Lewis. He says, artists are living in the present, thus writing a detailed history of the future. So it's like, be here now. Everything is happening now. All times are happening now. And in the midst of this, all at onceness, Marshall's saying from Ezra Pound that the artists are the antenna of the race. They're broadcasting the hidden effects of cars or of new art or of video games. They're broadcasting the hidden effects of these. Now, the main thing you can learn from studying Marshall McLuhan is that he said the question, why do we ignore the hidden effects? Because we get into them like a hot bath. We get into our internet radio and it feels good for this hour. Or if we're older, we open up the newspaper and drink a cup of coffee and it feels good. And it's like it doesn't matter what we're reading. It's the same stuff every day. The content. You know, here's the most, that's the most important thing. Marshall got all these from the poets. T.S. Eliot said, when the burglar goes up to the house to rob it, he's got a big juicy steak in his back pocket, and the guard dog comes out, and he goes, here, guard dog, and the guard dog grabs the juicy steak and runs off, and that's the watchdog of your mind. Most people, we are all paying attention to the content, and that's the juicy steak. Marshall was not saying, don't pay attention to the content. That's a big misunderstanding. When he said medium is a message, people go, he means you don't pay attention to the content, you only pay attention to the form. No. He was doing it as a Beavis and Butthead joker. He's saying, hey, the medium's a message. It was like, pay attention to the form also, because you usually just pay attention to the content. So
I think a great example of that, I mean, it's really just the internet and the way that people move through the internet. And again, the car attitude, or the same attitude is like, oh, this is a technology that gets me from here to there. It's like, oh, there's this great place I can go and like get free information. I just get free content. I cruise around. I'm liberated. I'm free. I can go wherever I want. Nobody's making me pay anything. This is delightful. But of course, along the way, we're leaving these breadcrumbs of data and statistics and demographic profiles, and they begin to cohere into denser and denser weaves of information that feed into these statistical machines of demography, of marketing, of statistics. And a friend of mine, he compared it to, we're bees and it's an orchid, and we're like, wow, this is a great meal. It's so tasty and it's free. But meanwhile, the thing is building an entirely different set of, like a city of data, but it's this impersonal data, this is statistical data that shadows us everywhere we go when we're online. But it's totally the juicy steak issue.
Well, and it really also gets translated into our physical bodies, right? People get so interested in the content, i.e. the juicy steak, they don't pay attention to their form, and then they get hugely fat because they're shoved on so much content. I think true of the internet too, right? Everyone's so interested in the content of the internet that they stop paying attention to their form, and then all of a sudden they get carpal tunnel syndrome and, oh my God, I need glasses because they can't see. So when they divorce those two of form and content, it affects literally our bodies are an example of that, not just the carriers of the example, but our kind of input reception receptacle, if you will.
Very good. You guys are great to talk with. Now, I'd love to explore two other things that Marshall brought up in our short time together here, and that's effects precede causes and sense ratio shifting. So effects precede causes was basically invented by Edgar Allan Poe when he invented the detective novel, and that's called reasoning backwards. So that is like Surratt prepared us for mosaic TV viewing by creating electronic pointillism. I mean, excuse me, by creating pointillism. There, I did effects for
right.
causes on
you
my own
same thing.
My own words.
Yeah.
Words evoke more than their meaning. You know, that's like George Carlin. He said, "How could we ever have a civil war?" And so, you know, words evoke more than their meaning. We're trying to operate on a perceptual level, and that's what Poe did, influencing the symbolists who spawned Jim Morrison and Patti Smith and Bob Dylan, because they knew that it doesn't matter what the word is, it's how it makes you feel. And guess who employed George Lakoff to get himself elected president with the exact same thing was Obama, because he said, well, you know, Republicans don't talk about issues, they talk about feelings. So why don't you try the feeling road, dude? And he went, hope. Wow, we'll sign up. So it's, and then, you know, here's the big one that goes right back to McLuhan. So you got Edgar Allan Poe to the symbolist. Then the symbolists spawn this whole thing, effects precede causes, and then advertising. And guess what Marshall's first book was? Written in 48 and published in 51, The Mechanical Bride from Duchamp, who's another key embrace of contradictions. I have forced myself to contradict myself in order to conform to my own taste. You know, Duchamp's a great one at... he ruined art. He made it a head trip. And so this whole thing, effects precede cause, continues to amaze me that Marshall was really, in his latest book, came out in 2011, for those of you who say, oh, Marshall's dead, new book, just came out, Theories of Communication, it's all about causality. We believe you do something, the cause, and then there's the effects. But it's effects precede causes, which we should all be trying to reinvent. Marshall was not about saying, here's a new theory, effects precede causes. Now, believe me, he was like, no, go out and reinvent what effects precede causes does. And what is it? So, you know, how do we... You know, there's a good one with one of my heroes' groups on Earth is Critical Mass. And, you know, they use humor so well. They're blocking the intersection in San Francisco with 500 bikes zooming through, and two people are holding up a sign in front of the cars that are waiting. And it says, thank you for waiting. And as the light turns green, the cars are pissed. I want to move. Get out of my way. So they start honking. So they simply flip their sign around. It says, honk if you love bicycles. So they get them to have self-realization rather than giving them a flyer or ranting at them on the radio. Give bicyclists their space. They get them to have a self-realization. And that is effects precede causes directly. Guess how we got roads? Because women wanted to go outside the city, and they built these little paths, which became bicycle paths outside the city. And guess what the bicycle paths turned into? Car roads.
So, the other example that I love is records, you know, LPs, you know, like all this great music, like all those wonderful, you know, like 20, you know, 78s from the 20s with jazz and, you know, hillbilly music and stuff. Well, the reason we have all these records is because they wanted to sell record players. They built these devices, you know, early wax cylinder record. Like, well, maybe people aren't just going to want to record. We got to sell them something. So we think about it like, oh my God, it's all about the recording. Who cares about the substratum? But, you know,
that's a beautiful example. I mean, effects precede causes goes on and on. And it's something that's so important to study and to think about and to reinvent. Just don't settle for it and go, well, that sounds good. I said at a cocktail party the other day, and she goes, you got to write that down for me. You know, from Poe to the symbolist to Patti Smith and the advertisement. And, you know, it's like, how do we reinvent? Now, sense ratio shifting is one of my favorites also.
Wait, hold on. I'm going to cut you off there because okay. we're at half an hour after the mark, and because this is a genuine fake radio show, we're going to take a break to hear some messages. This is Eric Davis. You're listening to Expanding Mind with Maja Daoun. We're talking with Jerry Fiaca about all sorts of amazing communication words, backwards, inside out, collage, mind space, and we'll be doing more of it in about 2 minutes.
On the Progressive Radio Network. I'm Maja Daou. We're here with Eric Davis talking to Jerry Fiaca, or Gerald, as his mother called him. and we've been talking about a lot of contradictions and talking about contradictions as well on our little fakey real radio show. And before the break, you started to mention, Jerry, about sensory ratios. And this is something that's interesting to me, too, because a lot of people with media, like we're talking about the Internet, everyone seems to only focus on the kind of intellectual and mind aspects of it. And then sometimes people will get into the physical effects of, you know, sensory stuff, like with the cartoons that cause epilepsy, or how cell phones can maybe give you cancer, and the effects of computer screens, and like I was talking about carpal tunnel. What do you think about the sensory, like physical form effects that this kind of media attention has on us?
Well, that's a very good question. I wouldn't want to ruin it with an answer, but I'll fake one. And sense ratio shifting, that was so well put. Sense ratio shifting is like when we invented spoken word, we shifted our senses. Maybe before that, all five senses were sort of equal. Then we invented printed word, and all of a sudden we became eye-oriented.
Mm.
So you know who's in tune to this is Jeron Lanier. He's the guy who helped invent the Internet, Rasta hippie dude. Like, I'm going to help invent the Internet. But years later, he goes, could we pay a teeny-weeny attention to the fact that it's changing us a little and we should be attentive to what it's doing to us?
Mm-hmm.
He knows because he read Finnegan's Wake out loud in his early days. Two things you normally don't do with a book. You're required to with Finnegan's Wake by James Joyce, a book that came out in 39, but it indeed is Facebook, and it is tweeting. And you take something and you flip it into its opposite. So you read a book out loud with a group of people. So James Joyce was allowing you to turn your eye into an ear. It becomes an ear experience instead of an eye. So then that sense ratio shifting, you're allowed. It's like a big neon sign. What is a reading a book doing to you? And so, you know, Ray Charles, backup singer, when Ray died, said he turned our ears into our eyes. So it's a constant shifting and floating around and changing. What does this new medium do to us? Because that's what sustainability is. That's what kids, you know, used to say. That's the field I'm going into, sustainability. Well, that's what Marshall called media ecology. And that is when a new medium comes in, how does it bump up to the old medium? So we're not going to get rid of horse and buggies. People still use them in Pennsylvania, and they're still efficient ways of transportation. But overall, we all switched over to cars mainly. So it's a constant thing. How does the old medium become an art form when the new medium comes in? And that's part in the sense ratio shifting. So how our senses shift and what becomes more dominant.
Like with vinyl records is a good example of that, how they're like an art form now, and the collection of vinyl has turned into this, you know, medium because of the release of digital music.
Yeah, and then Christian Marclais did it so well. He invented messing around with vinyl, like not, you know, how can I flip vinyl into this new, it's sort of like Zappa again, he used the recording studio as an instrument.
Mm.
So here's the medium we're listening to music in, how can I use that as an instrument? That's what Christian did so well. And So that whole sense ratio shifting is constantly happening. I think you brought up a good point when you said how cell phones, you know, the guy they hired to write a book on how, if cell phones affect our health, our body, he says, yep, they do, and he wrote the book, and they go, okay, you're fired, and they suppress the book. So it doesn't matter. Everything we invent has services and disservices. Okay, you know, if AIDS was created in a laboratory, it has services and disservices. If what's my favorite is Vanity Fair calling conspiracy theories literature criticism. Boy, if you have a conspiracy theory nowadays, you're a kook, you know, oh, that's kooky. But it's really an awareness level thing. Oh, I'm aware that there's this point of view and that point of view, and there's a million points of view in between. And let's do two main Marshall things you can memorize and put up on your refrigerator. We shape our tools, then they shape us. Pattern recognition equals comprehensive awareness. So if you study the patterns, then you can get a big picture view. So you take the cell phone, people keep them in their pocket all day, keep them on vibrate. End of the day, they take it out of their pocket, put it on their bedside stand, and guess what? They feel phantom vibrations on their leg. And they go, someone must be wanting to get a hold of me. And we did that before cell phones. We had landlines only, and we'd be in a room, and we would go, hey, did I just hear the phone ring? Because we were like, there's telephones, and someone must be wanting to get a hold of me. So that is what's called the Android meme. That's what Robert Dobbs has called the Android meme. We, as humans, start imitating the hidden effects of the things we invent.
Absolutely. And we model, like the way that we model our minds as computers, and you know, we talk about multitasking, and we sort of get to this place where this increased kind of, you know, networking through social media and through our hand devices, you know, in particular. And it's really interesting, as somebody who doesn't have a smartphone, I mean, I do have a cell phone that I don't always bring with me, and I often turn off, but you know, I'm not completely off the grid or anything with the telephonic devices. But even that, you begin to tell the difference, like when you're at a social gathering, how it's going to go one way if somebody has a smartphone and another way if they don't. And it's like I'm starting to become aware of these like parallel worlds that are laid atop each other. Like they're literal physical in space worlds, because we're moving through physical space with these devices. We're not just sitting behind, you know, our computer. So you can really palpably feel the way in which these things mediate different worlds simultaneously.
Feels the main word, Eric. You're both perceptual here. We're not trying to be conceptual. Concept is services and disservices. It's a word, and it's something that we've invented, and you can Wikipedia it. But it evokes more than its meaning. Concepts con you into believing that that's the way something is. Nothing is the way it is. It's always in flux. Everything is always in flux. But it's helpful to have concepts. So again, one of Marshall's main things was everything we invent has both services and disservices. And it's better to have, when you're out with one or more people, to not have a point of view. And then you can survey the services and disservices and get the bigger picture view of this technology. In your lonely teenage room, you can go, I hate cell phones, or I love them. But when you're with one or more people, try having what's called suspended judgment. And then back to the head of our great fake radio show here, that this is a put-on, okay? And that's what Marshall was about, putting on. I'm a put-on artist. I put on events. And this was where we had this slew of authors trying to create the great American novel. And now we're trying to create the great American whatever.
Video game.
Video games are old, dude. Video games are old. It's like now whatever the new thing is, social network. But here's how you can study Marshall's put-ons, and it's really simple. And You go to VeniceWake.org. So we did a combo. We study McLuhan and Finnegan's Wake once a month at a library in Venice, California. And you go to VeniceWake.org, and you can find out more about it. But there's a great little hidden link on our page called Zero Point, and there's 22 Marshall books with the title of the book and who he was putting on. Now, none of us have time to read a book. And so we are too busy avoiding people, missing places, defriending friends on Facebook. So we don't have time to, or deleting emails. We don't have time to read a book. So just go there and you can read the book title. Again, there's like, you can read the entire book, Finnegan's Wake, by just saying Laugh Tears. I don't have time to read a 628 page. I'll just read Laugh Tears. It's all DNA. So you can read the title of Marshall's books and get the essence of what he was saying. One of his most important books is Take Today, the Executive is Dropout. That's 1972 when the hippies were just dropping out, the end of the hippies dropping out, and Marshall's going, well, Take Today, the Executive is Dropout. So again, he was a put-on artist, and he was saying, I know what the great American novel is. I know what the great American video game is. It's the front page of the newspaper. And guess what? You can't write the great American novel. It's already there. And guess what? I'm going to write my books as though they are the front page of a newspaper. That's why if you're a literature person and you read Marshall's books, you usually go, this guy's a poet. Or you go, this is shitty literature. You know, this isn't very good. Well, that's the whole point. He wasn't, it was just like, it's so counterculturally correct and academically professional to diss Finnegan's Wake. Well, Ulysses is probably the greatest book ever written. And then Joyce sat on the toilet after he got good reviews for that and farted out Finnegan's Wake and said, I'll show them. And people go, that's a big joke, or that's like tricksterism and coyote tricksterism. It isn't. That's back to Frank Zappa saying you can seriously do something non-serious very seriously. Joyce was very serious about creating social networking and disguising it as a book. And, you know, that's what really what we've been doing with our time together is we've been reading Finnegan's Wake out loud, you know, because we're all discarnate here. The American Indians did it well. They went from tent to tent after in the morning, after they all dreamt in the middle of the night. And they would walk up to the person and go, so what was your dream about last night? And then the person would go, well, there's a zucchini, and it was in the Salvador Dali landscape, and wow. And so the question asker was the co-creator of the dream. So if we're
all talking about McLuhan's put-ons on the radio, putting it out to people, does that make us put-out artists?
We're put-outs and put-ons, man. That's what I like. You really know how to play this doubleness and duality thing and how we flip it into the thirdness, you know, and how do we flip it into the thirdness? Don't settle for these, you know, like Eric at Oddball Film and Video, we had so much fun, and you felt like, you're just trying to out-quote me, dude. And it's like, I'm a put-on artist. I don't know what I'm talking about, and it doesn't matter. You know, we're just, you know, Marshall said, the word is now the cheapest and most universal drug. We're addicted to words. It's the drama of cognition. So we, you know, I'm an amateur. You know, it's like Pete Seeger said on the great Hugh Hefner documentary. He says, folk music is much too important to be left to professionals. You know, well, this is a hootenanny, you know. And so, you know, they asked Marshall, are you an optimist or a pessimist? And he says, well, I'm an apocalypse. You know, we're in big trouble. That's why.
It's interesting you raised that term, though, because that's one of the interesting things about McLuhan is that, you know, he was going to mass every week.
Oh, yeah.
And he'd go on
that.
Wednesdays. And he was a very, very seriously practicing Catholic. And some of his writings, turn on religion in a really interesting way, where on top of the pessimist and the optimist, there was a kind of, when he says apocalypticist, he means also a revelator. Not
right,
the end of the world, like, you know, where everybody, where everything falls apart. Although he had some of the things he wrote about the media, the future of media, had a very, like, dark conspiratorial cast. I mean, he really saw the hive mind, the network of control, the mind, you know, control aspects of our media landscape. And he even saw them, you know, sometimes in explicitly kind of Catholic conspiracy theory terms. But even more than that, it was like the apocalypse as this revelation, like the revealing of the of collapsing time. And that's a super trippy thing, because Kevin Kelly turned me on to this thing that has never left me. He said to me, he said, you know, the funny thing about technology is that all technologies that human beings have made, have used for, you know, century, for millennia, are being used now. And I went, what do you mean? And then he started reeling them off. And you realize that everything that people did, people are trying to figure out how to do it. They're reconstructing it. There's a whole huge world subculture of people who make flint knives and flint arrows, who use stone tools, who use primitive, you know, mills and presses, who try to reconstruct Assyrian war machines, who use, you know, bow and arrow. And you start to realize that technology isn't just this forward-moving, linear developmental process.
That's media,
but it's also a palimpsest. It's this this weave across time. And once you start to see things with that kind of depth of pattern, it's hard to resolve it into the optimist-pessimist camp, because there's so much resonance on any given slice of it.
Eric, that's perfect, because we're reinventing the tin can and the string right now. That's what we're doing, tin cans, Dixie cups, and strings. But some people might not know the root word of apocalypse means to reveal. Mm. But one great thing you brought up, and again, back to Robert Dobbs, who so astutely said that Marshall converting to the Catholicism was performance art. So contemplate that. That's a good one to smoke in your pipe. Because Marshall, you know, there's a great book, The Medium in the Light, all his writings on religion and spirituality, and you know, you one of the best things that people want to really get into Marshall easy is just Google his Playboy interview, and he says consciousness can be freed from the shackles of mechanical culture and enable us to roam the cosmos. That sounds like something you could put on your on this progressive radio station in its fifth year. Hi, I'm Jaron Lanier, and I read Finnegan's Wake Out Loud, and I know we can roam the consciousness just as Marshall McLuhan, or as Joyce put Marshall McLuhan's name in Finnegan's Wake, Effects Perceived Causes, and called a Marshall McLuhan. And this came out in 39, before no one knew what Marshall was doing yet. So that's like, he wasn't Nostradamus or I Ching. Every writer has ESP. And
well, I like, too, how, just talking about the apocalypse in the Book of Revelations and revealing things, if you read the Book of Revelations, it's all contradictions, right? What's in the Book of Revelations but that it gets, it's night during the day, or the night consumes the sun, or that it start, it talks about all these impossible contradictions that occur. And in the Book of Revelations, it's basically the sequence of events, of things that are seemingly contradictory and impossible, and that signals the end of the world. Right? So, I mean, it's just interesting that Marshall McLuhan might have really tied on to that, because it would have been in line with his entire methodology of thinking, that somehow this revelation was only possible through contradiction.
Beautiful. And I just dumpster dove a We magazine from 1974 in mint condition this morning out of a garbage can in Venice, California, and there was Salvador Dali interview, and he says there's this Catalan line that goes, mix things up, they'll hold together better. You know, we'll get it. We'll hold together better if we mix things up.
Mm.
So, you know, that's, again, you know, embracing contradiction. But then how do we take embracing contradiction one step further?
That's it. It's that third twist. It's because it's sort of like irony. I mean, a lot of people complain about, you know, the sort of dominance, the sort of like poison of irony, particularly in like my generation, the generation after me, where there's this kind of knowingness and people are referring to this and everybody kind of like wink, wink, and nothing really ever gets said. But that, from that perspective, there's something kind of lame about being, you know, earnest and like, no, we've got to bring back values and bring back honesty. And you're like, ah, it doesn't work like that anymore. It's the third move. It's the post-iron. It's the irony that goes beyond irony. It's the like the spirituality that evacuates spirituality and then, you know, steps beyond it. And it's tough. It's tough.
The challenge is there, listeners. Yeah, and you two too. There's the challenge, and it's like POMO decon, postmodern, post-postmodern deconstruction, man. And you know, Marshall said it well. He said, "This is a letter he wrote to Ezra Pound. I should prefer to defuse this gigantic human bomb by starting a dialogue somewhere on the sidelines to distract the trigger men." Or to needle the subnabulist. So that's why Joyce took the title of a folk song, Finnegan's Wake, with an apostrophe. Sex Proceed Causes, Frank Zappa years later says, the crux of the biscuit is the apostrophe. Mm. So he got rid of the apostrophe, and Joyce named his book Finnegan's Wake, and you always... People in big literature, big academic books and in newspapers always add the apostrophe back in because they go to Google and says, do you mean? So they add it back in, which is wrong. The name of the book is Finnegan's Wake with no apostrophe because Joyce was saying, Finnegan's, wake up. All you Finnegans, all of us people, wake up and stop ignoring the hidden effects of the things we invent. Now, here's the key back to Ezra Pound, a poet, outing your inner dialogue. The artists are the antenna of the race, and they're broadcasting the hidden effects of the things we invent so that we can cope with them. So when the futurist was asked, so what's going to happen in the future? He says, well, your cell phone's use is going to increase tenfold. And everybody in the audience moaned. Why are you moaning? You all got them in your pocket. You don't want to have them in your pockets that don't have them. But everybody's got them, so they're embracing them. And so they're not realizing that, well, how can we cope with this? So we're not slaves to our technology. We shape our tools, then they shape us.
Well, that's appropriate for me, too, because I actually have an apostrophe in my last name. Whenever I enter it in data fields, like for banks and stuff, they will not allow me to include the apostrophe. So I actually have to change my name, adapt my name to the technology and become something else in order to embrace it because they won't allow me to enter my name properly without the apostrophe.
Hey, Jerry, we have a minute left, and I just want to know if there's any place that people are listening can be pointed to online to read your stuff or find out more about your doings.
Yeah, venicewake.org and laughtears.com. And Eric and Masha, it's been such a joy and a pleasure. I'm jubilant with spending time with you. But let me end with this joke. And Marsha was all about great jokes. Well, they say cheesy jokes. Or this one person dissed his jokes as like being cheesy. Come on. Two caterpillars are on a branch, and they watch a butterfly fly by. And one caterpillar says to the other caterpillar, you'll never get me up in one of them contraptions.
All right, well, that's a beautiful place to end. Thank you so much, Jerry Fiocca. Good luck with all your communications, building new devices, resurrecting old ones. From me and Maja, out to you, whoever you are, keep your minds open.
This is Matthew Bogart, producer for the Progressive.